Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We don't know their names. Three American soldiers taken in an ambush where four comrades died early Saturday morning in Iraq's so-called Triangle of Death, south of Baghdad. Today, thousands of troops are searching door-to-door in palm groves and back alleys, in mosques and water tanks. The U.S. military says an al-Qaeda group has them. Two captured last year nearby were brutally tortured and killed. The story of this ambush says a lot about what's going on with the surge. Up next on Point, the capture, the rescue mission, and the risk outside Baghdad. I'm joined by Sudarshan Raghavan, Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Sudarshan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And I know that you are waiting potentially at any moment from a call from a high-ranking officer there on this search, but what is the latest that's known? What's the operation that's underway right now to try and find these three soldiers?
This is what we know so far, Tom. There are actually more than 4,000 ground forces scouring in areas around the town of Mahmoudiya, as well as Latifiya nearby. They're all south of Baghdad. They're doing door-to-door searches. They're going through buildings. They're scouring farmland. So the search is in full swing even as I speak. So far, the U.S. military has conducted 450 interviews with local citizens, and from that they've gleaned about what they call 55 human intelligence tips, and from which of these they've launched about 10 separate missions to in buildings or to do reconnaissance, basically tips that they believe are credible enough to find the missing soldiers. They've also, what we're learning here, they've detained 11 people, including four what they describe as high value targets, which they hope will provide them information to the whereabouts of the soldiers or really what happened to them. But from conversations I've had with U.S. military officials today, they still have a confidence that the best outcome, that the soldiers can be recovered safely, is still there. They have not given up the search whatsoever.
It sounds as though it would be a miracle, though we hope and pray for it. Remind us what happened here very early Saturday morning. You talked with one official there saying something pretty horrible happened last night. What happened in this ambush, as far as we know?
Yeah, things have been becoming a little bit clearer now in the past couple of days. There were two Humvees with these eight soldiers, seven American soldiers, and one Iraqi army interpreter. They were apparently stationary, and they were there to stop insurgents from planting roadside bombs. But from what we're hearing now, they're part of a larger operation. There were other units around them. And then suddenly, at about 4:44 a.m., one of the units heard an explosion. They started calling in, trying to find out the whereabouts of these eight soldiers. They got no response, so they sent off an unmanned drone over the area looking for them. And that's when the drone reported back images of the Humvees burning. And then they basically dispatched, the commander on the ground dispatched two separate units, patrols actually, to go and see what happened. And both of them encountered roadside bombs along the way. And by the time they got there, it was about an hour or so after the attack happened. Mm. And that's essentially they found two soldiers inside one of the Humvees. The Humvees were burning. Another soldier, a dead soldier, was found a short distance away from where the attack happened. And then there were three missing ones. So that's essentially it as far as we know now.
Now, the function had been, we initially read, to try and intercept IEDs, roadside bombs that may have been headed into Baghdad. What was this? Is this what it looks like they were doing? And was this related to the surge?
It's extremely murky still. We don't know exactly what these, I mean, whether they were actually tracking insurgents or taking roadside bombs into Baghdad, or they're actually there to prevent from planting them where they were. What we do know is that a bomb did explode, and it actually attacked this. It actually attacked this unit. The area itself, dubbed the Triangle of Death, is infested with Al-Qaeda elements and Sunni insurgents. It is a key entryway into Baghdad, and part of the, in fact, a very huge role of these troops in this area is to prevent Al-Qaeda elements, insurgents, and from bringing in bombs into Baghdad and creating other types of mayhem there.
The U.S. military is saying pretty clearly they believe it is, in fact, an Al-Qaeda-related group that has these three missing soldiers. Is that right?
That's right. Yesterday they said that for the first time, and from what we're hearing from our sources, they're basing it on a couple of their sources, which they say are highly credible. But at the same time, it's really unclear. There has been no actual proof that Al-Qaeda linked militants are actually holding the three soldiers or have harmed them in any way. I think it still remains to be seen what exactly or who exactly is holding these troops.
Now, what about the statement? What about the statements by this so-called the Islamic State of Iraq, an Al-Qaeda cover group? Who is this? And what are they saying in their public statements?
Right. The Islamic State of Iraq is an umbrella group of Sunni insurgents. It is said to have been created by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's sort of what you might call an Al-Qaeda front group. They've been making pretty much the vast majority of the claims of attacks in Baghdad and elsewhere since the surge began, and in some cases, they've come up, they've shown brutal videos of their members executing Iraqi police soldiers and army. The thing is, they've claimed that they've captured the soldiers, but they've yet to provide any proof on their websites. They've provided videos before, but this time there's nothing of that sort, at least as of now. So it's really hard to say whether these claims at this moment are accurate or not. But having said this, there was an incident in June last year in the very same area when U.S. soldiers, a couple of U.S. soldiers were kidnapped and then brutally murdered, showing signs of torture. And at that time, the Al-Qaeda group basically took responsibility for that as well. And today it's widely believed that they were indeed responsible for those attacks, for that attack.
Their web posting on these three and the ambush on Saturday says it was revenge or payback. Payback for what?
Yeah, they're saying it was payback for the rape and murder of a 14-year-old local girl from the area by American troops, American soldiers. It was one of the most horrific incidents, cases of atrocities committed by U.S. troops in Iraq. Three American soldiers have pleaded guilty to those charges. So that's what's supposedly the reason for the capture of these troops. But what was also interesting in their statement is that they also mentioned the incidents of Abu Ghraib prison as well, which involved American soldiers. So definitely, whether it's true or not, certainly for propaganda purposes, they are linking the capture of these troops, the attack on Saturday, to these two events, two incidents.
And Sudarshan, you write, in the midst of the surge, this latest attack on Saturday is just the latest in a series of targeted strikes against American soldiers in recent weeks, with very high single-day death tolls resulting. Remind us, April 23rd, and then again a week ago Sunday?
Right. On April 23rd, in Diyala province, there was a twin suicide truck bombs basically rammed into a a remote combat outpost stationed by American troops, killing 9 U.S. troops and injuring 20 more. And then just last Sunday, there were, I believe May 6th, there was another attack in Diyala province. A massive roadside bomb exploded killing 6 U.S. soldiers as well as a Russian journalist all in one vehicle. So definitely the tactics here, the insurgents are certainly becoming much more brazen. What we're seeing here is more frontal attacks happening, certainly, and as well as the hit and run tactics. And if this is true, if indeed the Al-Qaeda linked militants do indeed have the three American soldiers, it would basically represent sort of the biggest such incident since 2003, when Jessica Lynch and her comrades were taken then.
We're talking this hour about the desperate hunt for 3 captured U.S. soldiers in Iraq, the rescue mission, and the risk outside Baghdad as the surge rolls on. Sudarshan Raghavan is with us from Baghdad right now. Joining us as well from Washington is Greg Jaffe, military reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Greg Jaffe, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We want to get a sense of what it's like to be out in one of these posts. You've been very recently with U.S. soldiers on the other side of Baghdad, on the north, in a town called Tarmiya, if I've got that right, a place where you said Americans, if they spend longer than 10 minutes in any one place, a sniper will track them down and begin shooting. What did you find in this pod of American soldiers you dropped down into there in Tarmiya, Iraq?
You know, I guess it's a little bit of the downside of the surge. Tarmiya had been kind of a model place a year ago. There was a fairly large presence there of Iraqi army soldiers, essentially a battalion of 300 to 400 guys. They got shifted to Baghdad to help with the surge there. There was a fairly large police force in Tarmiya that then quit after the Iraqi army guys left because they were out there on their own. So it left a fairly small group of American soldiers in Tarmiya on their own to try and at least hold the place together a little bit.
About 50 U.S. troops in a city of 30,000, no Iraqi police, them hunkered down, you say, just walking a simple foot patrol through this little city north of Baghdad has become unthinkable. And you quote one of them saying, it's getting to the point where we really cannot interact with the people. How bad has it become there, Greg?
You know, it's clearly a bad situation there, and a lot of the Sunnis who've come there have come from Baghdad, where they've been feel like they've been driven out by militias or whoever there, so they arrive in Tarmiya already kind of angry and primed for whatever messages they're going to get from the more radical elements there. It's certainly a bad situation. I think the military is betting that Tarmiya is not as important as Baghdad, and that we can afford to have some disorder there for the next several months while we stabilize Baghdad.
That disorder has come at a very significant price to soldiers there. You describe an incredible attack on their position, sort of straight on with a truck full of explosives, and then all the attack that came behind and the death and losses that came with that. Sudarshan Raghavan, what are you hearing from U.S. troops outside Baghdad as the surge goes on? Are they being left thin, vulnerable?
Well, I mean, you know, once again, it varies on which U.S. troops you speak to, but certainly there is a sense out there that there's questionings, you know, what exactly are we doing out there, and also whether or not we have enough resources. That seems to be a constant refrain. A couple of days ago, we had the top general up in Diyala province saying that he doesn't have enough troops to really push to quell the insurgency up there. Certainly, as U.S. troops focus in on Baghdad, you're seeing quite a number of fighters pushing up into areas like Diyala, and unfortunately, from the military perspective, there aren't enough troops up there to handle with this increasing influx of very dangerous elements in their neighborhoods.
Greg, on the north side of Baghdad, what happened in this town? You describe Tarmia. On the surface, pretty peaceful place. U.S. Began to put $16 million campaign in there to rebuild the city's schools and clinics and sewer systems. Soldiers called it the petting zoo because top generals would come in and see it as an example of a success story. And then, what, in December, the 150-man Iraqi police force there came down to the patrol base, took out their weapons, said they were going on patrol, and never came back. 2 months later, those Americans under serious fire. Describe to us the attack on their patrol base, if you would, Greg.
Well, it was a pretty horrific attack that they held off. They came under fire from, they think, about 70 to 80 insurgents who pinned down the roof guards. The roof guards ducked down and a big car bomb swept into the facility and literally blew off the front of it. It looked like the Oklahoma City bombing. Mm. And the soldiers then managed to fight from that building for the next 3 or 4 hours to hold off the sort of insurgent assault. Virtually everyone who was in it was wounded. So their actions were, you know, truly heroic that day and holding off the assault, and it was a really horrible position that they were in.
You describe one private there, Trent Gray, 20-year-old from eastern Kentucky, coal country there. As that attack came on, his head squirting, pumping blood through his fingers where he was wounded, thinking to himself that he would, if the enemy made it into the compound, he would kill himself with his 9mm pistol. You quote him saying, "I don't want to get my head cut off and have my wife watch it on the internet." I mean, that kind of possibility clearly very much on these soldiers' minds.
I think it is, yeah, particularly with events like this one this past week, although this happened before that. But it is on a lot of their minds. It was a really desperate situation. I mean, it's hard to conceive how they must have felt.
Tough duty on the north side of Baghdad. We're looking at the south today. Greg Jaffe with the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Sudarshan, you say that there is still hope for these three. It sounds kind of incredible that can be. What's the source of that hope? Once they're gone into whatever maze and network that's there, why would their captors ever let them go alive?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And when I describe hope, I mean, I'm describing from what I'm hearing from U.S. military officials. They are, you know, as long as they haven't found any bodies yet, as long as they believe that they're still out there, they're giving it all their best, and they feel it. It's a duty to the soldiers. It's the motto is we're not going to leave any soldier behind. So the sense I'm getting from my discussions with U.S. military officials, they haven't given up yet. But of course, I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, they could be kept alive, to add more pressure on the Bush administration. I mean, I was talking to one, our staff was talking to one reputed, Al-Qaeda figure yesterday, and he was mentioning that he believed that they still may be alive because they could be used for propaganda reasons, have a video, put them on television, calling for a U.S. troop withdrawal, any sort of way to, in what they would say, to try and humiliate the Americans here. So that could be one reason why they still may be alive. But, as each day goes by, as each hour goes by, actually, that hope, sad to say, fades.
I was stunned by the quote from this guy, Muhammad al-Janabi, a reputed al-Qaeda member in a nearby city, Salman Pak, and he told you guys, the Washington Post, he was so plugged into American politics. He said, talking about these three soldiers, "I can assure you that we will start pressuring Bush in a new way at the same time he is facing pressures from the Democrats and the American people." Wow, this is right on the ground there. And he said, "And there will be no problem to sacrifice 10 soldiers, that is his own, in order to abduct a single American soldier and get him on television screens begging for us to release him." That's a high level of integration with the American political conversation.
That's right. I mean, this war is pretty much unlike any other war in history. Everyone here has access to round-the-clock news, the insurgents, the Al-Qaeda elements, the Shiite militias, they're all looking on websites, they're all reading things. Almost all of our articles, like most of our articles, American newspaper articles, are translated here into the local newspapers in Arabic. So there's a lot of information out there. And what is really, I think, surprising to me is that so many of the insurgents and other groups are so plugged in, so in tune with what's happening in Washington. They are literally watching the politics unfold. I mean, I was just down in Najaf where I was speaking with members of Muqtada Sadr's movement, and you know, and they kept mentioning that they were talking about how the Democrats in Washington were basically in tune with their own ideology of wanting a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal. So they're watching all of this very closely.
Wow,
what's happening in Washington.
What a picture. And those three soldiers in their hands. Let's take a call from Tim in Portland, Connecticut. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. On point as always. Thank you.
Great.
You asked about the bigger picture. I was just reflecting on the unfortunate consonance between search and surge, and as your commentators have spoken, it seems as if a significant portion of our search is now dedicated to this search for three troops, and just, I suppose, the bigger picture in symbolic terms, if not just tragic, ironic terms, is that there really is no way out except that we're searching for our soldiers to find a way out. There's a political and military disaster that's unfolding in greater and greater terms here, and it just seems to me that we all have to go back to the horrible statement of mission accomplished, and then later on, bring them on, because they're coming on. And it would seem to me that whether or not we get these three soldiers back, which I don't think we will, I think the maximum political gamesmanship will be played by Al-Qaeda, and this will simply put greater pressure on political forces at home to demand benchmarks, if not a timetable for withdrawal.
Yeah. So much pressure when something like this happens, and so many troops devoted to it. Tim, thanks for that. Let me go to Washington for some perspective here. Carter Malkasian joins us. He's director of the Stability and Development Program at the Center for Naval Analysis. As a civilian, he was out as an advisor on counterinsurgency with the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force between 04 and 06. Carter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
First of all, in your gut, do you think these three can be found?
I think there's a possibility these guys can be found. There's no reason at this point that the military won't be able to collect the intelligence to eventually find them. Although, on the other hand, there's been some bad incidents in the past. So I'd say it's still up in the air in many ways.
4,000 U.S. troops in on this. It was 8,000 last summer when those other two who were eventually found tortured and killed were being hunted for. 4,000 is not an insignificant part of our combat force in Iraq. Is that an appropriate deployment?
That is a large number of men, but I'm not sure exactly how they calculated that number. I'm not sure if that also involves people in Baghdad, people in Al-Anbar, people in the Salman Pak area looking as well. They probably have a fairly wide search area that they're looking through. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they've gone and taken people from, say, Mosul and put them down around the Mahmadiyya area to look for these guys.
And what does it tell you about Al-Qaeda, some group of it apparently, that they've been able to pull this off, about their capacity and where they stand vis-a-vis the surge and the long arc now of the war?
There's two possibilities here regarding Al-Qaeda. One of them is this was a very carefully staged ambush to take out this outpost, and that they've been planning this for some time. They've been looking at how our troops deploy and think about ways at which they can capture guys. That's one possibility. Mm. The other possibility is it was simple luck, that they got in some lucky shots. They took the initiative, they grabbed these guys. They could have even been local insurgents, and then they handed them over to Al-Qaeda, the larger Al-Qaeda throughout Iraq.
Do you assume that has happened? I mean, they've locked down the town and the region around it. They're going door to door, putting the big X on every house that they've gone into, looking, we're told, in every cubbyhole and water tank, and you name it. But what kind of network might these American soldiers have been shuttled into? How strong, how healthy, how far afield could they be already? Could they be hundreds of miles from there?
It is possible that they could be hundreds of miles away. I'd say that's probably, I can't really speak to the extent to which that's likely. The al-Qaeda network is probably strong enough in that region, though, to hide them. Now, that doesn't mean that intelligence assets won't be able to find them, that they won't be able to find some Iraqis willing to help us and help give intelligence. It doesn't mean that other Iraqis didn't see these guys being shuttled off somewhere. So it's possible through good intelligence work, through careful discussions with the population, that they could find them.
So there is a prayer. Let me go to Lawrence in Aiken, South Carolina. Lawrence, you're on the air.
Yeah, a point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Them guys, first of all, would have never been taken prisoner if they had ammunition, okay? I understand from the show I watched that they take 200 rounds with them on a patrol. I was 4 years in the military. 200 rounds ain't going to last you diddly squat, okay? Where was the backup for these people? Why wasn't somebody 3-4 minutes away? And if you're going to fight a war, why don't you fight like the Israelis do? When you go into a house and you search it, you don't find anybody, bulldoze the house. It's over and done with. These guys just run back and forth on you. If you're going to fight the war, fight this war. Don't fight it political.
Lawrence, we hear it, and there's a bunch you put on the table right there. We'll hold bulldoze the house for just a moment, but Sudarshan Raghavan, Lawrence asks, do they have enough ammunition, and why didn't they have more and quicker backup? From what you know of how these patrols work, what do you say?
Yeah, those are very interesting questions, because in most times, in most cases, certainly the embeds I've been on, usually you don't see two Humvees by themselves. It's usually a convoy of three or four, maybe even five or bigger. There always seems to be a good amount of backup. But in all fairness, when I spoke with the U.S. officials today, I mean they basically insist that these guys were not operating independently by themselves. That around them there were a good amount of other U.S. troops in Humvees with heavy protection around. Is that this particular assignment was basically tracked down people who were dealing with roadside bombs, and it was sort of essential to have it with two Humvees stationary in one place, and which was a decision made by commanders on the ground. But by no way are they saying that these guys were not in any way unprotected
and
vulnerable.
In the timeline, we see 4:44 the attack came, 4:59 a drone sending back pictures of those Humvees on fire. Carter Malkasian, you looked at counterinsurgency. Our caller in South Carolina says, if you knock on a door and they don't have the soldiers, bulldoze the house. Is that the way to success here?
No, I would suggest that's not the way to success. Generally, when our tactics have been more brutal, all it's done is create more insurgents. If you bulldoze the house, that family and elements of that tribe will join the insurgency against us. Now, there is, of course, a certain horrible logic to that. If you bulldoze enough houses, if you cause enough destruction, you can cow the entire population to listening to you and doing what you want them to do. However, I'm not sure the United States is willing to countenance that level of destruction.
Do you think it would work if they did?
Well, if you embraced a horrible amount of destruction, yes.
Adam is calling from Boston. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really appreciate your show. I've been listening since you started. My question is regarding the propaganda value. The first thing that I heard regarding the report of the missing soldiers were specifically that it was revenge for the rape and murder of the girl and her family.
Mm-hmm.
Have we done any kind of prosecution or court-martial of those soldiers? Has anyone reflected upon the fact that the girl, if she had been raped by one of her own countrymen, would most likely have been victim of an honor killing? And lastly, but not really related, does anyone know what happened to the interpreter?
A bunch of questions there. Sudarshan Raghavan, how do you respond?
Yeah, well, with interpreter, in the end, he was one of the five that was killed. So there were four U.S. soldiers killed, mm-hmm. including the interpreter. In terms of the... there were three U.S. soldiers who were who pleaded guilty, but I haven't been following the events that closely back in the States about what the what the status of the other troops are, other soldiers involved in the rape and murder.
I don't have all the details. At least one has been sentenced to a very long sentence in response to that. Qadir Malkazian, you see al-Qaeda here, I don't want to say making hay, because the rape and murder of a girl and of her family is heinous, but this is being put front and center in the postings about this capture. How do you think Iraqis respond to that? Do they buy it? Do they believe it? Or is it sort of just framed up for world consumption, that this is revenge for that?
Well, they're probably framing it for both Iraqi and world consumption. The unfortunate thing is that that incident is going to turn Iraqis against us, without a doubt. And however al-Qaeda is using it, there's a good chance it is going to turn more Iraqis against us, perhaps not turn them towards working with al-Qaeda, but turn them against us and perhaps against the Iraqi government as well.
I want to turn to a voice in Los Angeles. Philip Carter, former Army captain, was in Iraq from October 05 to September 06, was stationed on an outpost in Bakuba, north of Baghdad, in Diyala province, a tough province itself. Captain Carter, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
We appreciate just your thoughts as the country and the world look on as these three soldiers captured in a pretty hellacious situation there. You've been there. How do you look out on what we're all staring at right now with the kind of horrified fascination?
It's obviously every soldier's nightmare to be captured, particularly by this enemy. You try to minimize your risk of doing it, making sure you have communications with your higher headquarters, rehearsing response plans, and so forth. But it can happen. It's extremely rare to see this kind of ambush, even today. You typically don't see al-Qaeda or sectarian militias or insurgents massing in this form to attack a U.S. force sort of mano-a-mano, but it happens. And my hope and prayer is that we'll find these guys.
Do you have a sense, do you hear from fellow officers or officers in the field that they are now more vulnerable, that they're stretched thin by the surge, by the focus on Baghdad, that this is part and parcel of our current strategy?
I don't think that anyone feels more stretched thin by the surge. I think the sentiment is rather that things have been ratcheted up a notch, that we have really decided to take this offensive to the enemy, and that the enemy is going to respond in ways that they think are going to undermine the will of the American people and really strike back at us in a way that inspires fear and terror in our hearts. And kidnapping is one of those.
Let me go to John in Charleston, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hello, this is John.
Hi, John. What do you know?
I think this is an overall strategy of the administration where they said we want to fight them here so we don't, in Iraq, so we don't have to fight them at home. And in doing so, they've not protected the borders, they've not disarmed the insurgents, and our boys, our men and women over there are no more than bait. And so it doesn't surprise me when you see an ambush like this take place. Lost a young man, and I taught in Sunday school when he was 9 or 10 years old over there in a military intelligence office that was simply overwhelmed by suburbans and well-organized insurgents. And they picked their targets carefully. And they can do this. I'm a veteran, and I'm ashamed of the way this has been prosecuted over there.
Let me put it to Captain Carter. I should say first, CNN is now reporting that the three missing soldiers are from Fort Drum in New York State. We do not have names there, but Fort Drum apparently as their home base. Philip Carter, what about it? Is it fair what we're asking of these troops? We're reading in reports now from Baghdad of, you know, some determination around Iraq, determination, but also a sense that they are hanging out there when the strategy is not clear, feeling sort of dangled, and our caller points straight at that.
It is a fair criticism. The counterinsurgency manual the Army just published says it at the top of Chapter 1, counterinsurgency is the graduate level of war. It is a very tough type of endeavor. It is much tougher than the conventional operations that the Army and Marine Corps train for. And it oftentimes requires putting young men and women in complex situations for which their past training and equipment and leadership may not be perfectly ready. And they have to make the best with it that they can. I know we faced a number of situations from working with the jails and courts to negotiating political deals that we weren't trained for. That said, I think American units are uniquely equipped to do this, and they are oftentimes incredibly flexible and capable on the ground. The larger criticism that your caller just made about not sealing the borders and not doing a census and not taking all these other steps that we should have done in 2003 and 2004 is also a valid one. But at this point, I think we really have to focus on the war that we have now and not the war that we should have fought 4 years ago. And if we want to succeed, that we could probably still implement some of those measures and do well.
Carter Malkasian, what about the sense of fairness in Greg Jaffe's story of the assault on a U.S. Base in Tarmia? These guys were thin. They were nearly overwhelmed. He was back weeks later, and they still had, you know, bodies full of glass from the blast that had happened on that day. Is it fair what we're asking? Our caller says he's, as a veteran, he's ashamed at soldiers being kind of hung out there without sufficient support and backing. What do you think of that criticism?
In a way, I see two questions there. One of them is that we have people out in rural areas trying to provide some modicum of security so that al-Qaeda and other insurgent actors can't get back into the area and reestablish it as a safe haven or a stronghold. Because once that happens, it becomes very difficult to clear the area again, and there can be a lot of pain and destruction, obviously, involved once that has to happen.
But in this base in Tarmia, they were only holding on to their base. They couldn't even go out on foot patrol. The soldiers were saying, "All we're holding the flag here, showing the flag here because we can't retreat." But 50 guys in the city of 30,000, they were clearly, with all the police having walked off the job, they're not controlling it.
No, they probably were not controlling it as well as they should have. And in those kind of situations, there's an important question that has to be answered as to, is it worthwhile to maintain the forces there to prevent the insurgents from really holding a safe haven there? Or is it better to cut our losses and go back in later, not to risk the lives of those men? To counterinsurgency in general, though, does require dispersed operations to be effective at it. Mm-hmm. Requires the use of small units, requires operating with local forces in small numbers of advisors. So no matter what, you're going to be facing risks like this. And in some places like in Al-Qaim or Ramadi or evidently in the heart of Baghdad, we operate in enough density that there's enough small units moving around that they seem to be safer. But in other areas, it's not always the case. And usually when you go to dispersed counterinsurgency operations, you can get higher casualties for a period of time. Now, over the long term, that should decrease as you become more effective as you suppress the enemy. But there is that risk there, and it should be understood.
We're feeling the pain of that risk right now, today, for these three missing soldiers and for everybody in this situation. Let me go to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Salma. Salma, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just calling to respond to an earlier caller from South Carolina who advocated using house demolition as a means of making these people cower. And I was shocked that even that concept was entertained on the show. House demolition is against international law. And the discussion that pursued about destroying Fallujah, flattening Fallujah without any consideration for 600,000 Iraqis that have been massacred so far because of this war. I'm just lamenting the level of discussion on this talk show this morning, and I'm just very disappointed that the U.S. has to follow the foot of a country as oppressive as Israel in leading this endeavor in Iraq.
Salma, when we speak of flattened cities, we take the pain of that to heart. At the same time, I mean that is a desperate idea, and house demolition, obviously a desperate measure. We're not promoting it, but you see where the conversation's gone. Philip Carter, what about the learning curve on counterinsurgency? You know, right now I'm sure there are doors being busted down pretty fiercely in the hunt for these men. We've had callers suggesting even more brutal tactics. Do we get in a catch-22 where the violence required to follow up on a capture like this, you know, just breeds another round of death and resistance?
I think that's right. The central challenge of counterinsurgency is the calibration of force. If you go with too much, as Carter Malkasian said earlier, you might actually suppress the population and achieve security for a while, but you will create many, many more insurgents than you capture or kill. And if you go with too little, you create a vacuum that the insurgents can come into and raise anarchy. And that has actually been the case throughout much of Iraq, where there's been too few forces and too few uses of security or force. And so We've sort of ceded ground in a number of places in western Iraq and southern Iraq and also in northern Iraq. But this is the central challenge, and it takes very smart-minded soldiers with a lot of intelligence and a lot of time on the ground and cultural understanding to get that right. And even then, there are mistakes.
Sudarshan Raghavan, you're there in Baghdad. How do you think this whole incident is going to ripple through the U.S. community there, the military community there? What's the morale picture? How do you see it?
Well, it's anyone's guess. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on what happens to these three soldiers. One thing I'd like to mention is that, you know, we're already hearing complaints from people, residents in Mahmoudiya, of searches and raids and in their homes as U.S. and Iraqi forces try to find any sort of information about the missing soldiers. So already there's a growing discontent in the way the operation is being handled, certainly from the perspective of Iraqis down in Mahmoudiya. The other interesting thing here, I think, a point that Nisi mentioned is that as the search goes forward, as this new counterinsurgency plan pushes forward, you're seeing U.S. troops on the ground are increasingly relying on locals and as well as Iraqi army forces for intelligence and essentially for their safety as they move out into remote combat outposts or pushing into areas where the insurgents know the territory extremely well, and that's essentially a key reason why you are seeing a rise in U.S. casualties, particularly by roadside bombs over the past couple of months. And it's because, you know, they're entering extremely hostile terrain where just a couple months back were basically completely no-go zones.
Sudarshan Raghavan in Baghdad, thanks for watching this story with us. Thanks for being with us today. Sudarshan Raghavan with The Washington Post. Carter Malkasian at the Center for Naval Analysis, thank you very much for joining us. And Philip Carter, former Army captain in Iraq, thanks to both of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.